The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. 90 minutes ago, the Supreme Court issued their decision on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, and we are going to spend the next 60 minutes dissecting the policy, legal, and political implications of that decision. We've got a slate of great guests joining us this hour, and we'll start by the person who's been on the show a couple times this spring, previewing the arguments, then dissecting the arguments that were made during the oral arguments earlier this spring, and now telling us a little bit about the decision. That's Dr. Karen Teel, one of my colleagues from Patton Boggs, where she advises our clients on public policy and healthcare matters. Karen, I know you've been parsing this very quickly since it came hot off the presses 90 minutes ago. So why don't we start by having you recap what the holding of the Supreme Court was today?
Well, thanks very much, Kevin. And yes, we've been exercising our speed reading skills because this is a 193-page opinion of the court. But basically, for those who were listening last time I was on, what was up, there were two ways that the government was going to expand, Congress was going to expand insurance coverage, and that was through an individual mandate where people would be required to purchase health insurance and there would be penalties if they did not, and tax penalties if they did not. And the second was by doing some Medicaid expansions, taking Medicaid, the existing program that's for the blind, the disabled, needy families with children, and expanding that to uninsured adults that whose incomes were up to 133% of the federal poverty line. So those were the two ways that the volume of the insurer was going to increase, and that was really the basic premise of much of the Affordable Care Act. What happened today was in a 5-4 ruling where the Chief Justice Roberts agreed. He wrote the opinion for the court, joined in that was Justice Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Breyer, and Justice Kagan. They said that it was very interesting because the original challenge to the individual mandate had been brought against the United States by states and National Federation of Independent Businesses and some individuals that said, well, the Congress has gone too far. That's an inappropriate, unconstitutional exercise of Congress's powers under the Commerce Clause. And that here, Congress was not regulating commerce, it was actually creating commerce. And in fact, the court agreed with the petitioner's argument on that. And it said that the Commerce Clause presumes the existence of some commercial activity. And here, there wasn't a commercial activity in existence. This new requirement to become insured, mind you, that doesn't start till 2014, was Congress creating something. So the court found that the individual mandate was not permissible under the Commerce Clause. But for those of you who keep a handy pocket edition of the Constitution handy, all you have to do is go up literally two sentences in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution to find what Congress did.
And that that caused some initial confusion on the network
because
they were
confusion.
Reading as they went,
yes.
And they said, oh, unconstitutional, and then, oh, constitutional.
Yes, and what the court did was find that it was constitutional under the taxing authority of Congress because the penalty for failure to become insured, the court said, yes, that's a tax. And because they was acting like a tax, The court then reached up, and it was the alternative argument of the government, that it did have the authority to do this under the Congress's taxing authority. And using that argument, the court found, yes, the individual mandate was upheld under the taxing authority of Congress. Then it also said, well, because they had labeled it as a penalty, Congress had labeled it as a penalty rather than a tax, one other thing called the Anti-Injunction Act, which means that no court can look at a tax before the tax is actually imposed, because Congress had been, frankly, I guess, crafty enough to call it a penalty rather than a tax, that did not invoke the Anti-Injunction Act. So
yeah,
with that argument, free and clear, there's an individual mandate.
I know some folks have been holding out hope that the Anti-Injunction Act would actually give the court an out leading up to the election to say this is not a ripe issue for us. You know, come back to us after Kevin O'Neill's been assessed the tax or the mandate or something else.
Right, and the court is very clear on that. It says the Anti-Injunction Act, therefore, does not bar this suit. So then moving on, the other thing was the expansion of the Medicaid population. So the court here has one limitation, and the limitation is that in the Affordable Care Act, there were all sorts of requirements that states would have to expand their Medicaid populations up to people with 133% of poverty, and these people would have to get 10 categories of essential health benefits that are also described in the Act. What the court has said is one additional provision is unconstitutional, and that was that the Secretary of Health and Human Services could penalize a state for failure to comply with that, to expand that program by withholding all of the federal dollars that would normally flow to the state for its existing, the basic Medicaid program. That's where the court said it went too far, and it used some very colorful language here. He said this was pressure that had actually turned into compulsion, and that the inducement to carry out the Medicaid expansions by putting funding for states' existing Medicaid programs in jeopardy amounted to Congress putting a gun to the head of state Medicaid programs. So basically, the court is saying that was too far, Secretary. You can't, you know, threaten states that way. So states now can opt to do the Medicaid expansions without fear of being, or opt not to do them without fear of jeopardizing their entire Medicaid program. And the court said, with that correction, the any concern they had about the Medicaid expansions was settled. So, you know, we really do have a very you know, if you want to use terms of victory, a very big victory for the proponents of the Affordable Care Act individual mandate. The Medicaid expansions is going to involve some more analysis depending on what states do or don't elect to do under that provision.
Interesting. You know, I walk in the halls real quickly. I had a lot of people in here watching the news. One of the things that surprised was maybe not so much the decision as that it was Chief Justice Roberts that was the deciding vote here as opposed to the traditional swing voter, Justice Kennedy. I guess I want to know if that surprised you.
Well, actually, it didn't surprise me because a few days ago I had changed my view. I had thought the individual mandate would be overturned, and I changed my view just recently that the whole thing would be upheld, not anticipating this little twist with the Medicaid expansion. But it's very interesting. You know, Justice Roberts wrote the opinion for the court. Justice Kennedy joined the dissent that has Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito in it, and then Justice Thomas did another just short page, two-page dissent of his own to further elaborate on some of the concerns he had about the Commerce Clause. But I think that's the surprise, and I think some people would have thought that Justice Kennedy would be the swing vote, and potentially Justice Roberts might have joined him. But in fact, and we haven't, you know, had the chance to, you know, go through the dissent yet and see, you know, what Justice Kennedy was joining in that dissent.
Oh, I'm sure the dissent, if Justice Scalia has written something, is quite a page-turner. Let me turn the page, though, a little bit here, Karen, and ask you. Obviously, you guys are tracking reaction to the court's opinion. We know the president is about to make a statement from the White House. I believe Governor Romney is teed up to speak after the president, closer to the top of the hour. Speaker Boehner's put out a press release. What are you doing to sort of collect all that and get it out to folks?
We are monitoring all sorts of reaction, as you said, from the president to Governor Romney to what the different health associations are saying, what different members of commerce are saying. We're compiling all of that. And most important, and for your readers, we are doing a memo on taking apart the decision. People are going through summarizing it right now. And then with that, it'll summarize, you know, what the court said on each of these different challenges to the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. And we'll also have a section with our initial analysis and interpretation of what this means, what Congress is likely to do, what House Republicans might be likely to do, what states might be likely to do. And that is something that will go out to our clients first, of course, but then it's going to be posted sometime by probably mid-afternoon on the Patton Boggs website, and that will be www.pattonboggs.com.
Very good. I'm sure a lot of people will be hitting that to check it out. We'll see the talking heads yakking in the background here on the TVs. Karen, anything else that surprised you substantively about what you've seen and read in the decision so far?
Actually, no. I thought it was very interesting how they got to, you know, the main concern in all of the discussion has been about the Commerce Clause and how the court, in a way, surprised us, I think, by looking at Congress's authority under the tax provision of that same article. But in fact, that had been the government's alternative argument. At first they said it's not a tax because they didn't want to invoke the penalties weren't a tax because they didn't want to invoke the Anti-Injunction Act. But then the government actually argued, well, it is a tax, and that way Congress had the authority to do this. So it's just very interesting, and certainly the oral arguments never really, that I recall, concentrated on that argument. They were all about how far can the Commerce Clause be pushed. And here I think the court really wanted to say, we don't want to engage in any more pushing out of the Commerce Clause, so we're not going to be doing that today. We're going to be looking at a different part of the Constitution.
Yeah, what surprised me was conventional wisdom in Washington leading into the oral arguments was absolutely the court is going to uphold this on the Commerce Clause grounds that, it's merely an extension of cases leading back to President Roosevelt's early days. And then after the oral arguments, they savaged the Solicitor General, and conventional wisdom shifted over time to basically say, oh, the mandate's absolutely going down, and now the question is the rest survives.
Right.
And I have to think, I know I'm very surprised today by the decision and perhaps the line of reasoning that got to it, and I suspect as I see the talking heads in the background as well that a lot of folks were very surprised. And I guess it just shows that the questions they ask don't really tip their hand in the way that we suspect they do.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Very interesting. Well, again, what looks like the president is just a minute or two away from coming on and speaking. Karen Thiel, everyone, if you want the Patton Boggs summary of the health care ruling on the Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court decision that came out just a couple hours ago, we do anticipate that being posted on our website at www.pattonboggs.com sometime in the next couple of hours. Karen's probably not even allowed to leave the building for lunch until she gets that out.
No lunch today.
No lunch today. No free lunch. That's a tax, whether or not you want to call it a mandate, according to the Supreme Court, Karen. With that, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be back in just a minute to talk a little bit about the political implications of the Affordable Care Act decision today coming out of the Supreme Court.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We're spending this hour dissecting the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act. They've decided that it is constitutional and perhaps chosen a relatively unique path to get there, depending on one's legal opinions here. We are joined now for this segment to talk a little bit about the political fallout and what's next for some healthcare entities. We're joined by my colleague Marty Kendrick from the law firm of Patton Boggs. Marty started her career working for the predecessor agency to HHS and now spends her time helping clients navigate their way through complex healthcare regulatory problems involving Congress and executive agencies. Marty, welcome back to the show. And we spent all this time talking to Karen about the opinion, so I have to ask, what's your opinion of the Supreme Court today?
Well, Kevin, thank you. I have to say that I think it is an unequivocally brilliant opinion in that, it affirms folks in part, and it actually reverses in other part. I think that there is a big surprise in Washington that Justice Roberts got to the decision on the tax premise as opposed to the Commerce Clause. But, you know, the mandate was the centerpiece of the law, so the fact that the implementation of healthcare reform is going to continue is you know, I think a big win on the for the president and on the Democratic side, arguably.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I'm sure the president, who's speaking right now, is calling it a victory for all American people, is taking somewhat of a celebratory lap here this afternoon, and probably will raise his visibility over the weekend. So talk to me a little bit about what you think the political fallout's going to be for the president, and then we'll talk about Governor Romney and the Republican opposition.
Okay. Well, I think that it's going to present some major challenges for the president, too, because I don't think that the decision gets the president to universal coverage and full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and that's why I say that it's brilliant. It offers something in effect for everyone in terms of victory. I don't think that the Republicans who are addressing it at the moment are necessarily commenting on that aspect, but certainly this decision creates a degree of uncertainty in the political realm, because the states really will be in the driver's seat as to whether or not they want to proceed full board for implementation of the statute. And I think many of these governors in states and states' attorney generals where there's been opposition to the health care reform legislation now will have a choice about how willing and ready they're going to be to jump on to the expansions of coverage for the uninsured. So, in effect, I think Justice Roberts, in the majority opinion, in ruling that the Medicaid provisions of the statute really went too far, in terms of coercion to the states, in effect, you know, they're not letting the states, as they put it, let the gun to the head stand. So, I do think that the states will be in the driver's seat, and some states will choose that for whatever reasons they're not going to proceed with the expansions of coverage in the Medicaid programs and expansion of coverage to many uninsured. So,
well, Marty, you're talking about expansion of coverage on the one hand. Isn't it true some of these states had sort of delayed putting together plans for their exchanges on the thought that, hey, maybe this is all going to get overturned, and now aren't they a little behind behind the timeline for that?
Very much so. I mean, many states have deferred any kind of action and final decisions because they were waiting until the Supreme Court ruled. So, you know, states are really behind the eight ball. I would suggest that, you know, at best, Congress and the administration are going to be faced with some delays in implementation because a lot of states have simply not passed authorizing legislation that for the exchanges. They haven't developed their Medicaid implementation verification systems, and a lot of the mechanics that are needed to be in place to implement the statute have not proceeded because states simply didn't want to spend the money if, in fact, a significant portion of the law were to be thrown out. So we have, you know, a statutorily required deadline of January 1st, 2014, for the state insurance exchanges to be set up, and that time frame is now very short. And unless states act immediately, you know, many will not be able to find themselves able to participate in anything other than the federal exchange. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure and a lot of political dynamics that will be brought to bear at the state level now with the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, so let's switch and talk a little bit about maybe some of the political fallout for Republicans and for their presidential nominee Mitt Romney. You know, before we got this decision, Marty, you had some pundits who were saying sort of counterintuitively that the best thing that could happen for Romney's chances of victory and for congressional Republicans is for the law to be upheld because it would motivate their base. To me, that just seems wrong. I mean, a victory is a victory for President Obama. It's hard to spin that and say that's going to help you in November.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, the Republicans in Congress, as well as the presidential candidate, Mr. Romney, have both vowed to try to repeal the measure after the November election. So certainly, unless the Republicans adapt to a different strategy, which is very unlikely given the initial decisions in an initial rhetoric that statements that have come out this morning, it does appear that this will be an election year ballot kind of message, like the Republicans will run on a repeal platform, and the Democrats will try to raise a lot of money countering that message.
Marty, I know you represent some leading players in sort of the medical equipment space as well as some healthcare providers around the country. Walk me through how the dynamics have shifted in the healthcare marketplace as of about 10:30 this morning due to this decision.
Well, I think that the good news in terms of the healthcare marketplace for many sectors is that there will be continued stability in terms of implementation. I think that the consumer protections, which a lot of folks I think are just now appreciating more, will stay in place, and that's you know, that's a huge plus. I think there is, again, you know, going to be a very significant amount of instability on the Medicaid front and how states react to it. In terms of the health provider community, hospitals and the like. I think that this offers, this decision offers a degree of stability. I think that's true probably for the insurers and for others. But, you know, there are portions of the statute that are very controversial, and there are portions that, you know, people don't like. One example is the medical device excise tax. The medical device industry is responsible for significant innovation in our economy and a major engine for jobs, and there is a huge tax imposed that will take effect. So the medical device industry is an example of one group that's been pushing for a repeal of a portion of the bill, and I think that this decision will not in any way deter the efforts to try to get rid of that provision. But Kevin, I would hope that the decision actually helps people get to some better accommodation in a political sense, because the administration has been so unwilling to acknowledge that any portion of the statute is off base or faulty, that, you know, there's been a full board implementation, whereas, the Republicans, on the other hand, have been pushing for full repeal. And one could hope that in the future, particularly post-election, you might be able to get bipartisan agreement moving forward to refine some of the sections of the bill that are controversial and have resulted in a lot of a lot of churning, at least in certain sectors of the health economy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did spend some time with one of the leading players on the medical device excise tax this week, and that person predicted that basically when you get to the lame duck, that's the best opportunity to get that done. And that person pointed out that medical device excise tax, while being led by a lot of Republicans, had strong bipartisan support when it passed the House, and a lot of the states that are most most impacted by that device tax, Minnesota, Massachusetts, California, are states that are
in New York, right?
New York overwhelmingly to blue, Democratic politicians who have an interest in protecting what are leading manufacturers in each of those states.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Well, Marty, we got about 90 seconds left. Anything else you want to talk about in terms of the political fallout for the president, the Republicans, or even the congressional Democrats here?
Well, I think the Democratic statements that are being issued this morning are really touting a huge victory that, the Republicans basically, threw everything at this legislation and they lost. And so let's, use this momentum and carry it into November. And I think the Republicans, on the other hand, have a real challenge on their hands, because of this really is a decision that kind of upends their strategy in a real sense. And I think the Republicans don't have an alternative strategy yet for how to get to some of the positive aspects of the legislation and how to correct in an effective way some of the provisions that are deemed in a real bipartisan sense to be not necessarily the best provisions to remain in law permanently.
Well, that's a good segue. You know, we heard a lot about both parties doing game planning for the various outcomes of the Supreme Court, and we're going to find out this afternoon from the Speaker and from Minority Leader McConnell and congressional Republicans what their next step is going to be in response to the bill. I think this is probably not the outcome they thought they were going to be talking about today. It'll be interesting to see how it translates out on the election trail. We're going to be back in just a minute with more. We're going to transition and talk a little bit about what those congressional next steps are going to be when our next guests join us right after this commercial break here on Capital Thinking.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth?
The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patent Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patent Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patent Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we are continuing our discussion of the Supreme Court's decision on the Affordable Care Act upholding the constitutionality. We're joined now by two very special guests, Bob Dove, the former Senate parliamentarian, who now is an adjunct professor in the Federal Legislation Clinic at the George Washington University Law Center, and John Jonas, who is the head of the Patent Boggs Healthcare Policy Practice. And we've had a chance to kind of dissect the legal implications of the decision. Now we're going to talk about what Congress might do next. So, John, you and I had a very prominent bet in front of some of our colleagues. You've won that bet. The law has been upheld. So I proclaim you the best prognosticator on the Supreme Court. I bow down to your wisdom here. Now let's turn to Congress and tell me what you think is going to happen with the Republican-led House.
Well, I think they're going to continue to run the sort of same game plan, which is that this law is kind of fundamentally flawed and should be repealed, whether it's constitutional or not. I think essentially they were looking for the court to do what they probably didn't have the votes to accomplish, which is to overturn the law. And so now I think they're going to hope that they ultimately find themselves in a position where they have the votes to overturn the law. And I think the question for Republicans is a little bit is the public's interest in a war of infinite duration on health care reform really there, and will stretching this into kind of an endless battle over this particular act, is there really public support for that in the long run? And I think that's just something Republicans will have to gauge for themselves. I suspect the public was very much in it until the court ruled. But at some point, I suspect the public may move on a little bit on this issue, even if Republicans in the House seem disinclined to get there themselves.
Well, judging by the email incoming traffic, where if I had a dollar for every member of Congress who's sent me a copy of their statement, I could afford my own damn health care this morning. Obviously, congressional interest is very high. Bob, as the former Senate parliamentarian, I want to shift to you and ask a couple different scenarios. Obviously, Democrats control the chamber this year, so I want to know what you think they'll do with health care the remainder of the year. But also, there's a real good chance, 50-50 chance, Republicans might take the Senate come fall. What could happen if they're in charge next year and you get either an all-Republican Washington or you get at least an all-Republican Congress?
Okay, first of all, I don't think the Democratic Senate is going to touch this issue. Basically, they're very happy with the court decision. So there's nothing that really merits the attention of the majority leader, and he sets the agenda, and I think this will be a dead issue in the Democratic Senate. But next year could be a very different year. Basically, two things could happen to change things dramatically. One is that the Republicans could take the Senate. Now, I don't expect them to take it if they do take it by any great majority, but they could take it. And if they do take it, and this is a huge if President Obama is defeated by Mitt Romney, then the Republicans would be in the same position that they were after the election of George W. Bush in 2000, in which they controlled both houses of Congress and the White House, and they could use a technique which was used to pass the George W. Bush tax cuts. It's a technique called reconciliation, and it completely avoids the need to break a filibuster in the Senate. A reconciliation bill cannot be filibustered, and that's the way, of course, the George W. Bush tax cuts go through. So whereas I think nothing is going to happen in the Senate for the rest of this calendar year, next calendar year, at least potentially, could be a very different year.
Well, Bob, let me ask you another related question to that, at least for this year. We're in the midst of passing the annual appropriations bills, the spending for all the federal agencies. Republicans, since they came back and took control of the House last year, have tried to sort of starve the beast with some of their appropriations bills, cutting off funding to various avenues that would implement slices of the Affordable Care Act. Will they ratchet that up right now? And if so, they have any chance of succeeding at the end of the year in the lame duck session when these bills get done?
Okay. I mean, as long as President Obama is sitting in the White House, and he has said he would veto any appropriation bill that came to him at this point, basically, all they're going to be able to do is pass a continuing resolution. And I doubt that that continuing resolution will make any major changes in the funding for the Affordable Care Act or frankly, anything else.
Well, yeah. John, you want to add something there?
Yeah, I would, you know, I think the Supreme Court decision really is a setback for the Republican effort to repeal this law. Yes, Bob Dove's scenario, of running the, you get a complete win in the election may transpire. But the problem is, for Republicans, is this law is going to continue to be implemented. And so just as we've seen with some of the insurance reform provisions, as the law gets implemented, I suspect its popularity will increase. So, for example, all of a sudden the exchanges come into being, and they're now a set of premium subsidies for individuals to go out, purchase insurance, and get a federal subsidy to help pay for that insurance. Well, once that happens, that gets much harder to repeal because all of a sudden – now it's 2014, and you're going to be taking away somebody's coverage that's now been granted to them. So I think the window for repealing this law is closing. Yes, there may be that opportunity if you have a complete election win, but absent that, if we have some sort of mixed configuration, this repeal effort gets harder and harder. And I think gets more and more politically complicated for the Republicans.
Well, I would agree with that, except if this election hinges on this issue, and right now I know that basically Romney is trying to make it hinge on this issue, then the question becomes, is there a mandate to undo this act as a result of Romney winning the White House and the Republicans winning the Senate? I mean, I have a feeling that, frankly, 2010 was a referendum on this act. And I just think it's fairly likely that if, indeed, that happens in the election in November, there will be enormous momentum.
Bob, I will agree with you. I think right now in an editing bay in Boston, some Romney for Romney campaign staffer is putting together a video that shows Obama talking to George Stephanopoulos 2 years ago and denying that this mandate was a tax, juxtaposing that with a Supreme Court decision today that in fact it is a tax, and saying the only way to get this tax out of your life is to make Mitt Romney president. I bet an ad like that will be out very quickly, and that you'll see those arguments coming from the campaign and from some others. I want to ask you a tangential question, which is, what does the Supreme Court decision say as a political shot across the bow to congressional efforts to rein in Medicaid and Medicare spending? Does it wave them off from that, or does it make it easier to tackle that in the next couple of years? Let me ask you that first, John.
Yeah, the Medicaid decision is really sort of interesting because it makes the Medicaid expansion under this act optional with the states. And I don't think anybody really expected that or saw that coming. Didn't see much discussion of that in some of the punditry that preceded the decision today. And so this will be primarily a state-level decision. But essentially, the benefits that the Affordable Care Act extends to Medicaid-eligible individuals by substantially expanding Medicaid eligibility as a result of this decision or optionals with the state. So a state can just say, we're not going to buy into the Medicaid expansion, and therefore individuals in our state who would have had access to health insurance through Medicaid expansion will not be eligible for that. And I suspect there will be some sort of red state governors who say, I don't want to see an expansion of the Medicaid program, and will opt out of the Medicaid expansion.
Bob? I would agree with that analysis exactly. I mean, to me, the most fascinating part of this decision was that statement about holding a gun to the head of the states and striking that down. So I can see that issue coming forward front and center.
And so you don't think this doesn't warn people off from tackling entitlement reform in the next Congress, Bob?
Again, depending on the makeup of the next Congress, my reaction is there isn't an option about not tackling entitlement reform. I mean, Medicare is going broke, and everyone knows that. So, you know, it's not an option to just ignore that, and I don't think that Congress has that option of just ignoring that.
Well, it's going to be, no matter what had happened today, we knew it was going to be a fascinating debate. I think it's going to be an interesting couple of months here as they sort things out politically and in Congress. We're going to take a break here for just a moment and come back and talk about some of the legal implications of various provisions in the Affordable Care Act. So please keep it here on Capital Thinking. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street, to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know.
Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, we have spent the better part of this hour talking about the Supreme Court's decision to find constitutional the Affordable Care Act this morning. And for our last segment, we are joined by one of the crack litigators at Patton Boggs, Laura Lemley Weidenfeld, who is, again, one of the leaders of our civil and criminal government investigations unit. She spends a lot of time in the area of fraud and abuse. And we wanted to talk to you, Laura, a little bit about what the government has in the Affordable Care Act. I know there's some funding for any fraud and abuse efforts. Start by telling us what's in the Affordable Care Act, and then let's talk about how the decision implicates that.
Sure. There are a whole bunch of provisions in the Affordable Care Act that go not just fraud and abuse directly, but also general integrity issues. The focus on fraud and abuse has been significant throughout the last several administrations, so that's not new. But what's new in the Affordable Care Act is the focus on preventing fraud before it happens and preventing waste before it happens. So trying to put in some integrity provisions on the front end. So some of the, and then also an additional focus on actual fraud and abuse after it occurs. So just some of, by no means all of, the integrity provisions that are in there is the most important for healthcare providers has been and will continue to be the so-called 60-day repayment rule, which requires for the first time explicitly that providers of healthcare under Medicare or Medicaid, and that's, you know, anything from hospitals to nursing homes to home health providers and to physicians, that if they receive money that they're not entitled to, so they get an overpayment from Medicare or Medicaid, they are now required to both report and repay that within 60 days of identifying that they've received an overpayment, or when they submit their cost report. Some hospitals, for example, submit cost reports to sort of true up the payments that they've gotten over the past year. And so that has been the biggest significant change, and that is in spite of the uncertainty around the Supreme Court's decision until today, that has really been chugging along, and there are it applies to providers. It applied to them immediately, so it applies to them today. There are some proposed regulations that were issued in February that comments were due a couple of months later, and are still being considered. So there are no final rules. But that's really changing already the way a lot of providers are doing business and was intended to significantly reduce the waste out there. Some other significant provisions were the so-called sunshine rules, which requires pharmaceutical and device manufacturers who make payments to physicians or to teaching hospitals, and those can be for consulting agreements, royalties, et cetera, to report all of those payments to the Department of Health and Human Services on an annual basis. And then that information will be made publicly available, presumably on HHS's website. There are some proposed regulations on that. They've not been finalized yet. But that's going to put a significant burden on the pharmaceutical and device manufacturers, and may not get a lot of enthusiasm, has not been getting a lot of enthusiasm from physicians and teaching hospitals. The ACA provisions also severely limit the ability of physicians to own hospitals. They require OIG, the Office of Inspector General, to implement provider screening procedures for providers applying to the federal health care programs like Medicare and Medicaid. You would think that there would have been a lot of screening procedures, but there really weren't. There's a provider enrollment form that just contains some basic information, and that's been about it. So what they've been trying to do with this new provision is they're now required to look at the licensure status of the applicant, do fingerprinting, do site visits, do database checks. It allows them to impose a temporary moratorium on enrolling new providers and suppliers if they deem it necessary. It also requires new providers to disclose their affiliation with other providers that had uncollected debt or payment suspension issues or who were excluded from participation in Medicare and Medicaid or had billing privileges denied or revoked. And there are a number of other provisions like that. One last one I'll mention is it authorized HHS to require nursing facilities that receive payments from Medicare and Medicaid to introduce and implement compliance programs within their facilities. So those are just a handful of the changes that the ACA requires that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and HHS generally believe can significantly cut back on the amount of improper payments, not necessarily fraudulent payments, but improper payments that are being made out to providers and really stop some of the real fraudsters from even enrolling in the program to begin with.
And Laura, as I heard you sort of tick through those, none of them seem to be implicated by today's decision. Is that right? Or
that's right. That's right. I really don't see any of these being affected by today's decision, which for purposes of certainty is probably a good thing because a lot of most providers have been moving along as if the ACA really is law, which of course it has been. So I don't
certain that they're in trouble.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of sadness that some of these didn't get turned over. A lot of them can be pretty onerous.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, in the times that I've spent working with healthcare providers, there seems to be a healthy sense of almost palpable fear that the government is spending a lot of time cracking down on fraud and abuse in your Medicare and Medicaid. I know there's been a lot of attention paid to what's going on with payments that seem to have made their way offshore to Cuba and whatnot. But that in their haste to sort of look in the couch cushions and find every last dollar, that the government is perhaps coming after some honest brokers looking to, you know, to turn up the odd wrong payment. Or can you talk a little bit about what the government's doing and how aggressive they are in this area?
Absolutely. They are super aggressive in this area. Like I said, this has been a priority for a number of administrations. So it's not like healthcare fraud enforcement is new, but it has ratcheted up to an unprecedented degree recently. They have a task force that's a coordinated effort between the Department of Justice and HHS Office of Inspector General that focuses on primarily criminal activity, typically the low-hanging fruit, a lot of which is in Miami, Houston, Los Angeles, Detroit, a lot of places where it's just straight clear fraud, where for a provider that's supposedly providing services or items doesn't even really exist. They're just a storefront. But they've also been focusing on the civil side a lot more under the False Claims Act, which is a way to attempt to go after fraud by getting the money back from Medicare and Medicaid and by penalizing with triple damages and penalties and all of that, too. And often the criminal and the civil go hand in hand. And those civil cases are usually brought by whistleblowers who are typically disgruntled employees, current or former, or competitors. So a lot of what's driving the enforcement against a lot of legitimate providers today is that whistleblower enforcement, where the whistleblower may not even really know what the real problem is. It may not be a real problem, but takes it to the government. The government starts investigating it. They have to investigate it hard, and now those investigations are being done both civilly and criminally at the same time. So that's imposing a huge burden. Another really significant provision of the ACA that goes to that point is the suspension of payments during investigations. It used to be that the government would have to keep paying providers for the services they were rendering even if they were under investigation and even if the investigation was indicating they really had engaged in wrongdoing. Today, with this provision, the government can and is cracking down and saying, no, you're under investigation for committing fraud. We are suspending your payments. If in the long run it turns out that you were entitled to all the funds and didn't do anything wrong, then that's fine. We'll pay you then. But for right now, we're suspending the payment so that all of the money doesn't go out there. So we actually have something to recover ultimately because we've already suspended it.
Laura,
and that's
fast,
putting some out of business.
Laura, real fast, hit people with your email address, and I've got to wrap things up.
Sure. Email address is L Weidenfeld, that's LWEIDENFELD at PattenBoggs.com.
Great. Laura's who you can hit up if you've got questions about fraud and abuse and your potential to be subject to an investigation in Medicare or Medicaid. As we mentioned a couple times during the show, Patton Boggs is in the process of preparing an extensive memo looking at the implications of today's Supreme Court decision. We expect to post that memo publicly on our website at www.pattonboggs.com sometime in the next 2 hours. So if you're interested in the subject and our take on what it means in the legal sphere, in the political world, or in the next steps of the legislative and regulatory agencies, make sure you go to PattonBoggs.com and download your copy sometime this afternoon. In the meantime, have a great weekend. We'll look for you next week as we celebrate July 4th week here in Washington, D.C. with more on Capital Thinking. See you then.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.